Good afternoon. For those of you who do not know me, I'm Charles Miller. I am the president of the Cincinnati chapter of the Federalist Society, as well as being an attorney here in town at Keating, Muthing, and Klee Camp. The Federalist Society is co-hosting this event with the Ashbrook Center of Ashland University. So on behalf of Ashland and the Federalist Society, I welcome you all here. We are pleased to have joining us today as our luncheon address speaker, Attorney General Edwin Meese III. General Meese, I'm sure, is a familiar name to everyone in the room. General Meese is currently the Ronald Reagan Chair in Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation, where he is responsible for keeping President Reagan's legacy of conservative principles alive in public policy debates and discourse. He also serves as chairman of the Heritage Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, which was founded in 2001 to educate government officials, the media, and the public about the Constitution, legal principles, and how they affect public policy. As you know, General Meese served as Attorney General under Ronald Reagan from 1985 through August of 1988. Prior to that, General Meese served from 1981 through February of 1985 as Counselor to the President, which is a senior position on White House staff. In addition to his background as a lawyer, an educator and public official, Mr. Meese has been a business executive in the aerospace and transportation industry. Mr. Meese is an important guest here today because the role that he served in the Reagan administration was instrumental in ensuring that nominees with a conservative judicial background and temperament who would follow the dictates of judicial restraint, who were originalists or textualists, would receive prominent consideration by the White House and be sent to the Senate as the nominee. Mr. Meese was instrumental in beginning this process that we are here to celebrate today. General Meese.
Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's great for me to be here and to join in this conference on probably one of the most important topics that we could possibly be discussing, particularly in view of the events that will be coming up a few weeks from now. It's a pleasure particularly to participate when the event is sponsored by these two organizations, the Ashbrook Center, which is not only an honor to a great man, but also the great work that they do in terms of teaching young people and providing information to the public generally on the Constitution and on freedom. And, of course, the Federalist Society, which is one of the most successful organizations, I think, in history, particularly in the field of legal education and the legal profession. In just a little over a quarter of a century, they have made a tremendous impact on the legal profession generally and certainly on legal education. We've had a great morning today, an excellent start to this conference. And many of the topics that I'll be talking about have already been touched on briefly, and I'm pleased to continue as I speak on the topic I was asked to talk about, which is reviving the Constitution in the eyes of the founders. Or in other words, what would the founders think of the Supreme Court today? It's a good question for a number of reasons, because I think we've seen a lot of interest in the founders recently. There have been some excellent books written. You've read or you've heard about 1776 and the book about John Adams and a number of others. We've had a lot of television documentaries. And I'm happy to say also there seems to be considerable interest in the Constitution. At the Heritage Foundation, earlier this year, we just put some ads on just a couple of talk shows inviting people to write in or send in on the Internet requesting copies of the Constitution. And to date, we've had requests for over 900,000 copies of the Constitution, which I suspect... So I suspect that that's about 890,000 people more than read the Constitution prior to this time. Well, to understand, to really talk about this topic, and to talk about the topic that was introduced this morning in the history of the Constitution, we have to really go back to the 1780s to find out what the founders really thought about, what they were trying to do, and how they developed the Constitution and some of the doctrines that were discussed this morning. They were dealing with two major experiences. The first experience, of course, was they had just come through the War for Independence, and in order to preserve the freedom of our people, they were very worried about how government would work. They had had the experience of a government that failed. Under the Articles of Confederation, the government was too weak to do the things that the emerging nation needed. And so they needed a government that was strong enough, that was able to do the things that a national government truly had to do. Defend the country, for example. They had, at the time, incursions by foreign armies on our borders. They had ships at sea that were being attacked by pirates and the navies of other countries. They needed a strong defense. They needed some ability to actually go ahead and deal with diplomatic matters with a bunch of European nations that kind of looked down their noses at this new upstart nation across the sea. They had to be able to have a government that was strong enough to and able enough to coin money, to set a monetary system in being, to regulate trade, to do things like establish a postal system. And these were all things that were necessary if they were going to have the successful commercial republic that the vision of the founders really entailed. But at the same time, they didn't want a government that was so strong that it would oppress the people as they experienced under the English rule that led up to 1775. James Madison put it well when he said, the job that they had was in framing a government which is to be administered by men over men. The great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place oblige it to govern itself. Well, the founders determined to deal with this dilemma of energy in the government versus oppression and loss of freedom by dealing with the subject of power. They were all learned men, and so they understood how it was, looking back on previous democracies that had failed, that it was the concentration of power that had led to oppression. And it's for this reason that they divided power. And this is really the essence of what we're talking about when we view both the Constitution and the judiciary. They divided power horizontally and vertically. They divided power vertically by giving certain limited enumerated powers to the federal government, and then they divided power horizontally, leaving the rest of governmental power to the states, and then horizontally by dividing the power that was in the central government among the three branches. And in other words, it was important that both the states and the division of power among the three branches of the federal government was the source, they felt, of the freedom of the people, preserving the freedom of the people. As a matter of fact, the role of the states, which was not particularly discussed this morning, was very important to them because they saw it as the government's closest to the people. Indeed, the states had been there before the national government was formed. And they also saw that it was important that the states be able to do their own thing, to adapt the laws and the major portion of governmental power to the needs of the people, since they were closest to the people in their day-to-day activities. In terms of the national government, as I said, they divided power horizontally among the three separate and independent branches of the government. But just having that kind of a structure was not enough. They needed to solidify that structure and the separation of powers, and that was one of the reasons for the written constitution as a check against the concentration of power and the oppression that would come from it. And so the written constitution, with its checks and balances, with its allocation of authority, and with its limitations on government power, was an important thing. As lawyers would say, they got it in writing. For our purposes today, it's particularly interesting to look at the judicial branch. Now, actually, this was a new idea, this idea of an independent judiciary. For the judges had been a real problem to the colonists before the 1775 war. Indeed, if you look at the Declaration of Independence, we all know what it says in the first opening paragraphs, when in the course of human events and so on, and that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Those are pretty familiar. But the Declaration really goes on for several pages, and in those several pages, it's really a list of complaints against the king. And one of their major complaints was against the king's judges. And that's why the Declaration says that that it has been that he, the king, has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judicial powers. In other words, limiting how judges can act. And further says he has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. Now, this phrase is very important because that is why the Constitution provides a judiciary that is independent of the elected branches, so that they would not be influenced by politics or by the popular whims of the public at a particular time in history. It's also why the Constitution provides specifically, and it's about the only place where it talks about these topics, it says that the judges would hold their offices during good behavior, in other words, life terms, and their compensation shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. A direct utilization of what the Declaration of Independence said was wrong with the judges under the king. In other words, judges were to administer the laws independent of politics or interests. But they were not to be independent of the Constitution. They were not to make policy or determine what the laws should be, because in a democratic republic, as called for by the Constitution, that was the job of the people's elected representatives. Ronald Reagan put this very well when he was presiding over the investiture of two justices that were mentioned this morning, Judge William Rehnquist as the Chief Justice and Antonin Scalia as an Associate Justice in 1986. And that was when he said, "The founders settled on a judiciary that would be independent and strong, but one whose power would also, they believe, be confined within the boundaries of a written constitution and the laws." In the convention and during the Constitutional Convention and during the debates on ratification, some said that there was a danger of the courts making laws rather than interpreting them. The framers of our Constitution believed, however, that the judiciary they envisioned would be the least dangerous branch of the government because, as Alexander Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Papers, it had neither force nor will, but merely judgment. "The judicial branch interprets the laws," the President said, "while the power to make and execute those laws is balanced in the two elected branches." And this was the one thing, he said, that Americans of all persuasions supported. And then he went on to say, and this is perhaps the important thing because the topic came up this morning about judicial restraint. He said, "The founding fathers were clear on one issue. For them, the question involved in judicial restraint was not, as it is not, will we have liberal or conservative courts? They knew that the courts, like the Constitution itself, must not be liberal or conservative. The question was and is, will we have government by the people? And this is why the principle of judicial restraint has had an honored place in our tradition. Well, judicial restraint involved deferring to the elected branches in those things that were properly within their domain and limiting judges to interpreting the law and interpreting the Constitution as those documents were written and not substituting their own judgment. The opposite of judicial restraint, of course, and of constitutional fidelity, as I like to think of as the essence of judicial restraint, is, of course, judicial activism. Recently, there's been some confusion sown by some opponents of constitutional fidelity about what judicial activism actually is. Some scholars have tried to muddy the waters by redefining judicial activism to mean any act by the courts where they would strike down congressionally enacted statutes. It's interesting to note that they talked about judicial activism only as referring to striking down congressional acts. That absolves them of having to analyze the Warren Court, which of course struck down state statutes, dozens of them in a single blow. But in any event, as former Chief Judge of the Fourth Circuit, Mike Luttig, said, he referred to this idea of that the scholars have tried to redefine judicial activism as sophomoric, because under this standard, then, there would be no way for the Supreme Court to strike down statutes that were actually at odds with the Constitution, which really is the basis for proper judicial conduct. In other words, this is kind of a red herring to throw off what judicial activism really is. Judicial activism is committed when judges substitute their own policy preferences, their political biases, or their own personal views for what the Constitution or statutes actually say. And that's the essence of the problems, many of which were referred to this morning. We have a very good example in a recent case just a couple of years ago of judicial activism, and that was in the case of Kelo against the City of New London. There, the court, on their own, or a majority of the court in a 5-4 decision, decided that public use would be expanded to mean public purpose, in which they allowed the city to take the home of a private citizen and give that property to another private entity only because that new entity would erect buildings that would bring in more tax revenues to the city, a direct violation of what the word public use had always meant up until that time and as the founders had in mind. One of the most egregious decisions, which vastly expanded the power of the federal government, was during that period referred to this morning under the leadership at that time of Franklin Roosevelt. And that, of course, was a case we all know from our law school days, Wickard against Fillmore. As we know, Article 1, Section 8 gives the federal government through Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. But when the court construed federal power to cover any activity that might affect commerce, such a broad definition means that today virtually nothing that is done is beyond the power of the federal government. Well, perhaps what might be very shocking to the founders, if they could observe our nation today, would of course be the enormous expansion of federal authority over the past 80 years, and that it happened at the expense of the states, which the founders sought to protect in the Constitution. In other words, when judges make the laws or change the laws, they are usurping the powers of the legislature, and that is judicial activism. It's interesting to note that Chief Justice Marshall promulgated the concept of judicial review, as we heard, but he was very definite on the limits of judicial power, and that is why he said that judicial powers, as contrasted from the power of the laws, including the Constitution, has no existence. Courts are the mere instruments of the law and can will nothing. When they are said to exercise a discretion, it is a mere legal discretion, a discretion to be exercised in discovering the course prescribed by law, and when that is discerned, it is the duty of the court to follow it. And this is the key thing that ought to be the rule plastered on the wall of every judicial chambers. Judicial power is never exercised for the purpose of giving effect to the will of the judge, always to the purpose of giving effect to the will of the legislature, or in other words, to the will of the law. Well, judges also commit activism when they usurp executive authority. Today we have the spectacle of judges running all kinds of executive functions, prisons, mental institutions, schools, even police departments, and many other executive agencies. That they have neither the legitimacy nor the competence to perform such a role doesn't seem to bother them. This is despite what John Marshall himself said on this subject when he declared, in Marbury against Madison, that the province of the court is solely to decide on the rights of individuals, not to inquire how the executive or executive officers perform duties in which they have discretion. Questions in their nature political, or which are, by the Constitution and the laws, submitted to the executive, can never be made in this court. Numerous examples of judicial activism that would seem strange to the founders exist today, but they particularly stand out in view of the concerns that the gentlemen who were there in that hotel or that room in 1797 in Philadelphia had in mind about concerning the freedom of the people, concerning the ability of states to act. In the 1960s, in the case of Baker against Carr and Reynolds against Sims, for example, as you remember, they required the states to turn the structure of their legislatures basically upside down. The states had organized legislatures actually before the Constitution was even written and before the national government was formed. As a matter of fact, the two-tiered legislature with two houses was the model for the U.S. For the U.S. Congress itself, having one house based on political subdivisions, the other house based and a portion on population. And yet, this 1960s legislation required both houses, and the representation of both houses to be allocated on the basis of population. I happened to be coming into state government at that time under then Governor Reagan, and I can assure you that this not only overrode the authority of the states, but also and their ability to determine how they would run their legislative bodies, but also it changed dramatically the political balance and the civic culture of the states throughout the country. Another example, of course, involves criminal procedure. In 1961 in Mapp against Ohio, and in 1966 in Miranda against Arizona, the Supreme Court literally nationalized criminal procedure and imposed requirements relating to the admissibility of evidence that had never been thought before that time to be within the province of the federal government. Now, this was in direct violation of the promises contained in the Federalist Papers, where Hamilton wrote in Federalist 17, he said, "There is one transcendent advantage belonging to the province of the state governments, which alone suffices to place the matter of relative power between the state and federal government in a clear and satisfactory light." He said, "I mean the ordinary administration of criminal and civil justice. This of all others," he said, "is the most powerful, most universal, and most attractive source of popular obedience and attachment." Well, in recent years, we have had, and this was referred to earlier this morning, we have had another way in which the court has gone far beyond anything that the founders would have even envisioned in their wildest dreams back in the 18th century. And that is the use of foreign law as a basis for interpreting the Constitution. We've had Justice Breyer, for example, talking about foreign decisions from Jamaica and Zimbabwe and India. We've had the Justice Stevens talking about how they should be subject to or use as a basis for their rulings the world community. We have had Justice Kennedy talk about, in one decision, referring to as support for his views, the Court of Human Rights in Europe and the European Convention on Human Rights. And we've also referred in a case to what he called foreign law and international materials, including treaties that the United States Senate has not ratified, as, quote, instructive for the court's interpretation of the Eighth Amendment. Well, obviously, if you look at what the founders had in mind, it is hard to understand how the Constitution could be subject to interpretation based upon foreign law such as this. Indeed, Justice Scalia, with his usual statements, said this. He said, "The prize for the court's most feeble effort to fabricate a national consensus must go to its appeal to the views of members of the so-called world community." He said, "Irrelevant are the practices of the world community, whose notions of justice are thankfully not always those of our people." And then he went on to say, in another case, he said, "The court's discussion of these foreign views is therefore meaningless dicta. Dangerous dicta, however, since the court should not impose foreign moods, fads, or fashions on Americans." Well, the use of foreign decisions, foreign law, doctrine, legal doctrine, is, of course, a fraudulent way. But it is even worse because the court too often has had a very selective and subjective use of foreign law, citing only those instances that agree with the particular justice's position and ignoring foreign law, often more voluminous, that would be taking the opposite's position. Again, Scalia says, "To invoke alien law when it agrees with one's own thinking and ignores it otherwise is not reasoned decision-making, but sophistry." Well, this the result of this use of foreign law has been to expand judicial discretionary power as well as to erode United States cultural and legal sovereignty. It reminds one many times when the judges do this. And why do they do it? They do it, of course, because they can't find any basis in United States law, in the Constitution, or in any precedent. And so they have to refer to foreign law if they are to try to make some basic case for their rather wild views. It reminds one very much about the old story about the drunk at midnight leaning against a lamppost. He is seeking support rather than light. But more recently, the court has done something that for the last 200 years would have been thought to be far beyond the imagination of most scholars, and that is their invasion of the province of the executive and legislative branches in regard to the conduct of war. In his concurrence in Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company against Sawyer, shortly after the end of World War II, Justice Robert Jackson stated that executive decisions concerning defense and foreign policy are not judicial, but should be left to the President and Congress. And he gave his reasons why. He said, "Such decisions are wholly confided by our Constitution to the political departments of the government, the executive and the legislative. They are and should be undertaken only by those directly responsible to the people whose welfare they advance or imperil. They are decisions of a kind for which the judiciary has neither aptitude, facilities, nor responsibility, and have long been held to belong in the domain of political power and not subject to judicial intrusion or inquiry." Well, beginning in 2004, and in four major cases since that, including the one in that year, the Supreme Court has expanded its power and invaded the province of the executive and Congress to disrupt practices and policies that go all the way back to the War for Independence. Again, to quote Justice Robert Jackson, this time in Johnson against Eisentrager, "Granting access to the civilian courts to enemy prisoners is contrary to common sense as well as contrary to the Constitution." He said this. He said, "Such trials would hamper the war effort and bring aid and comfort to the enemy. They would diminish the prestige of our commanders, not only with enemies, but with wavering neutrals. It would be difficult to devise more effective fettering of a field commander than to allow the very enemies he is ordered to reduce to submission to call him to account in his own civil courts and divert his efforts and attention from the military offensive abroad to the legal defensive at home. Nor is it unlikely that the result of such enemy litigiousness would be a conflict between judicial and military opinions, highly comforting to enemies of the United States. Well, in the most recent case, Bobidian against Bush, the court even went so far as to grant the enemy aliens captured in war to receive the writ of habeas corpus as a defense that they could use against their capture. The 5-4 decision caused Justice Scalia to explain in his dissent the dire consequences of such judicial adventurism. Justice Scalia said that, as he stated in his dissent that was joined by the Chief Justice, by Justice Thomas, and by Justice Alito, he said, "Today, for the first time in our nation's history, the court confers a constitutional right to habeas corpus on alien enemies, enemies that are detained abroad by our military forces in the course of an ongoing war." And then he continued, "The game of bait and switch that today's opinion plays upon the nation's commander-in-chief will make the war harder on us. It will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. That consequence would be tolerable if necessary to preserve a time-honored legal principle vital to our constitutional republic. But it is this court's blatant abandonment of such a principle that produces the decision today." Well, these examples of judicial activism belie the Hamiltonian notion that he expressed in Federalism number 78, when he said that the judicial branch would be the least dangerous to the liberties of the people, because he said the judiciary has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. Certainly, modern history shows us that today that's not the case. Well, how then do we revive the Constitution in the eyes and to the thoughts and visions of the founders? I would suggest to you that our morning speakers today have provided many of the answers to this question. One is, of course, as was mentioned in the excellent talk by Jeff Sikenga. That's a tough one, Jeff. But an excellent talk in which he talked about the necessity of the other branches, including the executive, asserting their authority under the Constitution, both to act and to interpret the Constitution itself. And this is something that is, I think, as he pointed out with the previous presidents who exerted that authority, a very important aspect of restoring the founders' vision of the Constitution. A second thing, as was talked about by both Dean Bilionis and Mrs. Long, was, of course, presidential appointments and how important they are. And Ed Whalen gave us some important aspects of how important this is as far as the future is concerned, this matter of appointments. There's one other aspect that I think is important, and that is educating public opinion. And this as to what the role of the court is. It is true, as was pointed out by Jeff, that the public generally adopts the views that, as he pointed out with regret, too much of the government itself holds, and that is that, in fact, in matters of the Constitution, the Supreme Court is supreme in every way. As a matter of fact, the court was so arrogant in the case of Cooper against Aaron that they themselves said that the decisions of the Supreme Court are the supreme law of the land. Well, anybody who has read the Constitution knows that's not true, and that there's a basic distinction between constitutional law, the decisions given by the court, and the Constitution itself. I had an interesting experience in the speech I gave in talking about the Constitution. I pointed out that in some law schools, the Constitution is hardly even taught, and that constitutional law is all that the law schools put out. And I said in the leading Constitution law casebook, the Constitution isn't even referred to or isn't even set out in print, except to, when you get to Appendix H. About 2 weeks later, I got a letter from a professor who will go unnamed, who said, "You talked about the leading constitutional law casebook, so you must have meant mine." And he said, "I want you to know in the next edition, I'm moving the Constitution itself up to Appendix A." But I would suggest to you today in this gathering that the Federalist Society, the legal profession generally, has a real job to do in educating the public on what the role of the various branches are in regard to the Constitution, and also that the Supreme Court is supreme in properly carrying out judicial functions, but is not the supreme branch of the government, having dominion over the other two branches or of the states themselves. Ed Whalen really talked about what the stakes are and also the views of the various presidential candidates. Every voter should consider this in the next election. And it was interesting to note in the memo that was passed out on the table there when you registered today that a good portion of the public, over 70% of the public, does consider the Supreme Court and judicial opinions important or very important or somewhat important. And only 23% say that that would not make the top 10 list of the things that are important as they go to the polls. I would suggest to you that we hope that they learn what is at stake, not just in this election, but in terms of the continuing effort. Because, indeed, in this election, as Ed pointed out, probably whatever that the primary candidates agree or disagree on, there can be nothing on which they disagree more than on what kind of judges should be on the Supreme Court and on this idea of judicial fidelity versus judicial activism. The founders gave us a truly great constitution. To paraphrase William Gladstone, it was the most perfect document ever struck in the history of mankind. We in the legal profession have a special responsibility to revive the Constitution as the founders adopted it some two centuries or more ago. And it is our duty to preserve, protect, and pass on to future generations this magnificent founding document, which has done so much to preserve the liberty of our people and which we need to continue to be not only a beacon and an example to other nations as it has been over the years, but something that will preserve liberty for all of future generations in this country. Thank you.